recall how it actually happened, but it wasn't by some grand decree. It's like trying to explain why nobody saw it once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before. And over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace for K2 Radio's Focus on Community. This is VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak, your host for tonight's program, and we'll be focusing on the Middle East. Later in our show, Wayne Bundy will join me here in the studio to talk about his experience hosting Middle East Exchange high school students. They were part of the YES program, a U.S. State Department-funded effort that brings high school students from countries with significant Muslim populations as a way to build cultural understanding between their world and ours. First, though, we'll be talking about the renewal of the Middle East peace process with Robert Jensen, an author and professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Before I introduce Mr. Jensen, though, I want to build the context for the program around excerpts from two speeches. The first is when President Obama addressed the Muslim world in Cairo 4 years ago. And more recently, Secretary of State John Kerry's press conference, where he announced the resumption of Middle East peace talks between Israel and the Palestinian people. So here, let's listen to President Obama from 4 years ago in Cairo.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect, and one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap and share common principles, principles of justice and progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings. I do so recognizing that change cannot happen overnight. I know there's been a lot of publicity about this speech, but no single speech can eradicate years of mistrust. Nor can I answer in the time that I have this afternoon all the complex questions that brought us to this point. But I am convinced that in order to move forward, we must say openly to each other the things we hold in our hearts, and that too often are said only behind closed doors. There must be a sustained effort to listen to each other, to learn from each other, to respect one another, and to seek common ground. As the Holy Quran tells us, be conscious of God and speak always the truth.
Now, that was near the president's opening remarks in his Cairo speech in May 2009 as he addressed the Muslim world right after he took office. Later in his speech, he stated that the second major source of tension between the West and the Muslim world was the situation between Israelis, Palestinians, and the Arab world. He reminded everyone that America's strong bonds with Israel are unbreakable. And after describing the history of Jewish persecution, decades of old conflict between the two peoples, and the responsibilities of the Palestinian people in shaping a peaceful future, he had this to say.
At the same time, Israelis must acknowledge that just as Israel's right to exist cannot be denied, neither can Palestine's. The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. This construction violates previous agreements and undermines efforts to achieve peace. It is time for these settlements to stop. And Israel must also live up to its obligation to ensure that Palestinians can live and work and develop their society. Just as it devastates Palestinian families, the continuing humanitarian crisis in Gaza does not serve Israel's security. Neither does the continuing lack of opportunity in the West Bank. Progress in the daily lives of the Palestinian people must be a critical part of a road to peace, and Israel must take concrete steps to enable such progress.
Now, 4 years later, there's been no such progress. The crisis in Gaza hasn't changed. Settlement construction continues. In fact, just yesterday, the Israeli government announced that it would take bids on about 1,200 new housing units on Palestinian territory. Now, John Kerry has the two back at the negotiating and had this to say last month.
We're here today because the Israeli people and the Palestinian people both have leaders willing to heed the call of history. Leaders who will stand strong in the face of criticism and are right now for what they know is in their people's best interests. Their commitment to make tough choices, frankly, should give all of us hope that these negotiations actually have a chance to accomplish something. I'm pleased to report that in the conversations we've had last night and again today, we've had constructive and positive meetings, both meetings with the United States present and also meetings with the parties by themselves. The parties have agreed to remain engaged in sustained, continuous, and substantive negotiations on the core issues, and they will meet within the next 2 weeks in either Israel or the Palestinian territories in order to begin the process of formal negotiation. The parties have agreed here today that all of the final status issues, all of the core issues, and all other issues are all on the table for negotiation. And they are on the table with one simple goal, a view to ending the conflict, ending the claims. Our objective will be to achieve a final status agreement over the course of the next 9 months. The parties also agreed that the two sides will keep the content of the negotiations confidential. The only announcement you will hear about meetings is the one that I just made. And I will be the only one, by agreement, authorized to comment publicly on the talks, in consultation, obviously, with the parties. That means that no one should consider any reports, articles, or other, or even rumors, reliable, unless they come directly from me, and I guarantee you they won't. The United States will work continuously with both parties as a facilitator every step of the way. We all understand the goal that we're working towards. Two states living side by side in peace and security, two states because two proud peoples each deserve a country to call their own. Two states because the children of both peoples deserve the opportunity to realize their legitimate aspirations in security and in freedom. And two states because the time has come for a lasting peace.
Okay, again, that was John Kerry speaking last month as he announced the resumption of peace talks between Israel and Palestine. And I apologize for the quality of that audio. It was pulled off of YouTube video, and I didn't do quite as good a job as I thought I did. But the question is will John Kerry's efforts, despite he sounds optimistic in one breath and recognizing the difficulties in other statements he made, will those efforts finally bring a solution to the conflict? So let's hear from Robert Jensen. As I mentioned, Robert is a professor of journalism at UT in Texas, at Austin in Texas. Along with his work there, he is the author of several books, most recently Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, and We Are All Apocalyptic Now, on the responsibilities of teaching, preaching, reporting, writing, and speaking out. And he is a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center, a nonprofit dedicated to social justice and ecological sustainability, which distributes educational resources and organizes community events about U.S. policy around the world. And lastly, 2 years ago, Robert gave the plenary speech at the Veterans for Peace Convention in Portland. Now, welcome to the show, Robert.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
So tell us, what's different now than past Middle East negotiations that the U.S. has facilitated?
Well, the simple answer is really nothing. It's, of course, hard to ever, you know, rain on the parade. Whenever there's talk of peace and negotiation, one wants to be supportive. But the question just isn't whether our negotiations go forward. The question is, what are the underlying conditions for those negotiations? Has anything changed? And if none of those conditions have changed, then it's unrealistic to expect that simply calling new negotiations is going to produce a new result. And that's what the United States is not talking about. You know, the underlying injustice of the conflict, the discrepancies in power on the ground, and the fact that Israel has demonstrated time and time again it does not intend to negotiate, and as long as the United States provides what has been basically kind of unconditional support for that rejectionist Israeli position, then the conditions will continue as they have. So I think a dose of realism is necessary here, and looking at it realistically, it's hard to be optimistic.
So, the renewal of settlement construction is an indication that Israel isn't negotiating in good faith again.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, that's no surprise. So just the other day, there was an announcement by Israel that they were going to construct 1,000 more units in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. These are territories that are, under international law, understood to be occupied territories, and this kind of settlement building and transfer of Israeli population to that area is clearly illegal. Again, it goes on because of that unconditional U.S. support. Without that U.S. support, the international community would have called a halt to this long ago, and Israel would either have to go forward completely isolated or heed international law. But the United States, of course, allows it to continue. So, you know, the speculation is that because Israel has also agreed to release some Palestinian prisoners, which inflames the right wing in Israel. There was a kind of quid pro quo where Israel makes this gesture of releasing, I think it's a list of 26 prisoners, and then as some sort of, you know, superficial indication it cares about peace, and then turns around and lets new housing units, which of course everyone understands, deepens the impediments to peace. You know, these housing units, this settlement building has been going on ever since the Oslo Accords in the Clinton administration, the last big burst of so-called peacemaking, where when Yasser Arafat signed a deal with Israel, Israeli settlement in the West Bank expanded dramatically. And if that settlement building is understood by everyone to be the greatest impediment to a meaningful peace in the Middle East, in Israel-Palestine, then the continuation of that settlement building is a pretty clear indication Israel is not interested in peace. And I think that's an important shift of frames. The Israelis love to talk about how they don't have a partner for peace talks, that no one on the Palestinian side is interested in peace. But I think Israeli actions suggest just the opposite, that in fact it's the Israelis who are not interested in peace. Now, if you go into Israel, you can find lots of right-wing forces who say this openly. The reactionary right in Israel has never been subtle about this. They want to drive Palestinians out of the West Bank. They want to create a Jewish state from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. But the mainstream Israeli politicians like Netanyahu have to be a little more subtle, and I think that's what we're seeing play out today.
So, as I understand it, the European Union has imposed their boycotting, or possibly the is it products made in the settlements? I mean, the European Union has taken a stand against the new settlements.
Yeah, there is talk, you know, about economic measures, but the truth is that's a pretty trivial response. The European Union, in not just matters around Israel-Palestine, but in matters of foreign policy more generally, has pretty much knuckled under to U.S. pressure for some time now. And they'll make these sort of rhetorical, symbolic moves, but they don't really mean anything. There has to be a concerted international effort to defy the United States, to take these matters into the Security Council, to force the U.S. to veto measures that would force Israeli respect for international law, you know, to kind of expose this kind of corrupt bargain. You know, people in the U.S. often look to the Europeans as a somewhat, you know, sort of saner voice in international affairs. But, you know, that voice that isn't backed up by real action doesn't really mean anything. So I'm not terribly impressed with the rhetoric coming out of the EU at this point.
Well, now they have gone into the United Nations. There's been vote after vote after vote that has been very, very lopsided on the settlement issue. I believe on the border wall, the separation wall. Anything that comes up regarding the occupation, it's been lopsided. The United States has vetoed dozens of resolutions, have they not?
Yes. Well, of course, you know, there's two kinds of resolutions at the UN, let's remember. There are resolutions in the General Assembly where these kind of votes that you're talking about are, you know, overwhelming in favor of Palestinian rights. But, of course, General Assembly resolutions don't really mean anything. They are pretty much symbolic. It's resolutions in the Security Council that matter. Excuse me. And there, listeners will remember, there are, you know, five permanent members of the Security Council. That's Russia, China, Britain, France, and the United States, and they do have veto power. And it's really in the Security Council where resolutions might mean something, where they might be backed up with, you know, some teeth. And so the United States, of course, has vetoed or threatened to veto resolutions so that they never even come up for a vote. And again, that's part of that unconditional U.S. support. It really takes three forms. There's the diplomatic support you're mentioning. There's the military support. The United States provides tremendous amount of military equipment to Israel. And then economic aid, you know, billions of dollars of a year in U.S. aid. It's quite striking that you know, U.S. aid, the most U.S. aid to any one country flows to Israel, which is, of course, a developed country. It has a vibrant and modern economy. So it's a little hard to understand why we're propping up a perfectly healthy economy when, of course, there are people around the world who could use U.S. aid much more productively. So that military, that economic, and that diplomatic support by the U.S., as I said, which has been pretty much unconditional, and by that I don't mean to imply that the U.S. and Israel never disagree or never fight or there never are policy squabbles. Of course there are, but the general tenor of U.S. support, especially in recent decades, has pretty much signaled to Israel that it can do whatever it wants. You mentioned the fence or the border wall, which is another important example of how Israel talks about being interested in peace but then acts in a different way. The fence or the border wall is not simply along the internationally accepted border. In places, that border wall goes into Palestinian territory, effectively appropriating Palestinian territory. And it's hard to imagine how you can argue that the unilateral appropriation of land is consistent with a desire for peace. You know, these facts are pretty straightforward. The fact that Israel can continue to argue that it's interested in a meaningful peace, that the United States officials will accept that argument and continue that support, tells you something about how kind of upside down this whole conversation is, how up is down, black is white, and nobody seems to bat an eye at these really quite striking discrepancies between what Israel and the United States say, and we just heard some of that in Obama and Kerry's statements and the reality of the situation on the ground.
So what about the quartet? Is there not a body of several nations that is also supposed to be facilitating these? Why is the United States working alone as the party that's supposed to help mediate a solution?
Well, the United States has appropriated for itself for decades now this role as the chief peacemaker in the Middle East, claiming often that it's a neutral broker, that it's the only nation with the power and the status to make this work. Well, there's some questions that need to be asked. One is, if the United States is backing Israel as it has for so long, how can it claim to be a neutral broker? And also, if the United States is the only nation with the status and the heft to do this, it's been remarkably unsuccessful in doing it, which would suggest that some of those claims are inaccurate. You know, what, again, is clear is that the international consensus for a just solution of the Israel-Palestine conflict consistent with international law has been in place now for decades. And it's not the United States' role as a peacemaker. It's the United States' role as an impediment to that international consensus that dictates the reality on the ground.
And that consensus is basically withdrawal back to the 1967 borders?
Yes. I mean, there are some difficult issues because of the what we call the facts on the ground. So, for instance, by international law, you know, the refugees who were forced out of Palestine going as far back as, you know, the original war for independence, those refugees do have a legal right to reclaim property, but it's hard to imagine that there's a way to make that work. So everyone understands that each side just realistically will have to give things up. The Palestinians who do have certain rights to resettlement, for instance, are probably not going to be able to ever claim those rights. There are these settlements on the ground, and it might be that there will be land swaps, that a return to the 1967 borders because of all this construction is simply not feasible. But those are questions that can be negotiated once there's an agreement that Palestine has a right to exist as an independent state. And that agreement, for all the rhetoric from the United States and Israel, is in fact not in place. After years of rejecting the very idea of a Palestinian state, Israel does now accept that concept. But it doesn't accept the concept of a meaningful, independent, and sovereign Palestinian state. The Israelis still want to claim the right to essentially control Palestine's borders, to, in fact, station military forces along those borders. I mean, the Israelis are claiming they support a Palestinian state, but under conditions that in no way resemble an independent state. And so that's another one of these sort of rhetorical games that are being played. And, of course, the problem here is that the United States public, to a large degree, is in the dark about this. You know, there's a lot of talk about the Israeli lobby and how it controls politics in the U.S. I don't know that I agree with that. I think that part of the problem is that, in fact, the United States public simply does not understand a lot of these basic facts. A friend of mine, Phyllis Bennis, who's a great analyst of the Middle East and international affairs, says that one of the problems with working on this issue in the United States, being an advocate for Palestinian rights in the United States, is that on a lot of issues regarding international affairs, the American public doesn't know much, and everyone's aware. So if you talk about, you know, certain foreign policy questions in Africa, people will readily agree they don't know much about that region. But Phyllis points out that the problem with the Israel-Palestine conflict is not that people don't know anything, but that people believe they know things, but unfortunately what they believe they know is false. And that's a huge wall to get over in trying to just make the facts clear in American political life. Again, this is not a new phenomenon. This has been going on for the better part of three or four decades now, ever since the U.S. swung its support in this unconditional fashion to Israel, which dates back to the 1970s now. We have decades of this problem, and Israel capitalizing on this U.S. support to further entrench its control over Palestinian territory.
So what do you see as the role of American citizens that do take the position of supporting Palestinian rights to a free state, an independent state, not one that has Israel control on its borders, not one where they have a buffer zone on the border with Jordan? If we're not, it's not our fight. Should we be, you know, advocating for either state, or should we be advocating for someone else to take over the negotiations?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that come to mind. One is to always remember that this is an issue, only one issue among many in the Middle East, and U.S. policy in the Middle East has been a disaster, not just in Israel-Palestine, but across the board, that the United States has really, in the pursuit of the control of the flow of oil and the flow of oil profits, that is, the United States' desire, recognizing the centrality of the Middle East in energy production, that the U.S. desire to dominate the politics of that region, has been a disaster across the board, and not just the U.S. invasion of Iraq most recently, but U.S. support for what are essentially feudal monarchies in places like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, the disastrous U.S. policy in Iran going back to its support for the dictator and now its entrenched resistance to the current Iranian government. All of these are part of a package, and we need to demand a dramatic shift in U.S. policy in the Middle East more generally. More specifically about Israel-Palestine, I don't want to pretend there's an easy solution here. Within those who support Palestinian rights, for instance, there's a debate about the one-state versus two-state solution. The traditional position was that the Palestinians simply need their own state. But many people within the Palestinian community now say that the two-state solution is essentially a fantasy, that the reality of this Israeli settlement is that there is no effective way to create a separate Palestinian state and talk about a binational state, a single state in Israel-Palestine based on democratic principles, where Israelis, Jewish Israelis and Palestinian Arabs come together with an agreement to create one state with rules that would respect the rights of both of these groups. Quite frankly, it's hard to imagine, given current Israeli politics, a one-state solution getting much traction. So, again, I don't want to pretend I have, you know, great insight here. We have a two-state solution that seems unworkable and a one-state solution that seems unworkable. And as citizens of the United States, I think our job is to tell our leaders that we want the U.S. out of this process, that the U.S. has no meaningful role in a peace process. We are we've corrupted that process and not fostered it. And so turning the process over to the appropriate regional and international agencies is, I think, the demand that the United States should make. And I think that's not only in the interest of justice for Palestinians, it's in the interest of a process of creating a just policy in the Middle East for the U.S. more generally. And that's not only the right thing to do on moral grounds, it's the sensible thing to do on practical grounds, because this policy of domination that the United States has been pursuing, you know, whether it's Obama, Bush, Clinton, you know, Bush, Reagan, Carter, I mean, go back as far as you like, all the way to the Nixon administration, what you've got is a policy that has sown the long-term seeds of disaster for the United States as well. And the U.S. invasion of Iraq was just the most egregious of these failed policies. So there's a lot of reasons that people in the United States should be asking our leadership to do what's right, but also to do what is in our own long-term self-interest. That is, if by self-interest we mean trying to create a system in the Middle East that is stable based on principles of justice, not principles of military and economic domination.
Well, let me ask one more question going back a little bit. You talked about the imbalance of power on the ground. If the United States wasn't back in Israel during the negotiations, there'd still be a substantial power difference. How would somebody else be able to deal with that, another a nation, other leaders?
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about Israel as probably the most potent military power outside of NATO. I mean, this is a nation with advanced weaponry and, of course, a nuclear capability. It's also a nation, Israel, with a very divided internal politics. There's something akin to a civil war possible in Israel between ultra-Orthodox factions and more secular factions. There are a lot of fault lines in Israel, and so I think there's been so much water through the turbines here that there is no simple solution. If the United States stepped back from its obstructionist role, it at least creates the possibility that Israel would be forced to come to the bargaining table in some sort of honest way, as opposed to now the sort of fake bargaining that goes on, where Israel essentially concedes nothing except a few symbolic moves. And Palestinians are left with either accepting an unacceptable situation or walking away. And then, of course, when Palestinians walk away from the negotiating table because the conditions are unacceptable, that's painted as a Palestinian, intransigence. And we're stuck. But the first thing is for the U.S. to get out of the way of a meaningful process. Until that happens, I think there's nothing but disaster in the future.
So, and that's what you see with Kerry's efforts now is probably another dead end.
I think it's in some sense it was a dead end. It was a failed process before it even started. Why Kerry pick this up? Why take on a negotiation strategy that's almost certainly going to fail? It's hard to know. You know, politicians have delusions of grandeur. You know, John Kerry was, a senator who occasionally showed some sparks of principle. Then he was a failed presidential candidate. And maybe this is his attempt to, resuscitate a tarnished image. I don't know. I don't pretend to understand the psychology of politicians. But it's a little hard to imagine taking seriously the project that he's undertaken here. I think that it's pretty easy to predict these talks are going to peter out and produce nothing. And the problem with that is not just that the talks fail, but that more time is lost, more settlements are built. And each year that this goes forward, it gets harder to imagine any peaceful settlement. And again, if that sounds pessimistic, it should be, because I think that kind of pessimism is called for. I wish I had a happier ending, but that's the way it looks to me. And, after about 20 years of trying to pay attention to this issue, I'm less optimistic today than I've ever been.
Well, and I think that's part of the possibly the people's view that one state is the ultimate solution, that once the settlements continue and there is no possibility of two states, it's all going to be absorbed by Israel.
I think that's true. And then Israel, of course, as people have pointed out, has the choice of remaining a Jewish state in which its Jewish citizens have rights that Arabs don't, in which case it has to essentially recognize itself as an apartheid state in a very formal way. It has to recognize it is in no sense democratic. That was, of course, the position South Africa was in, and eventually international pressure helped change that. And Israel knows that if it takes up essentially a South African model, it's going to have a hard time making any case for international legitimacy. So although Israel has the upper hand economically, militarily, diplomatically at this point, Israelis should be cautious about being too full of too much hubris, because those conditions can change as well. And, of course, there is a demographic reality as well. The Palestinian birth rate higher than the Israeli birth rate. You know, at some point, all of these realities are going to come crashing down. The U.S. could play a meaningful role in that, but it's going to have to change course in a very dramatic fashion.
Well, I want to thank you for your insights, Robert, and appreciate you being on the air at late in the evening at your home with us. We certainly didn't expect you to offer us a solution.
And, well, I'm glad to hear it.
Again, thanks for being on.
You bet. Great. Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to a discussion about the new Middle East peace process with Robert Jensen, a professor of journalism from the University of Texas at Austin. This is KTOO, and this is Peace Talk, a Veterans for Peace production on K2's Focus and Community. We're going to shift gears just a little bit. We're going to still be talking about the Middle East. In the studio with me right now is Wayne Bundy. Wayne is a local Junoite, has been works in the real estate industry, and he's been a host of one of the YES students for the past two summer or past two school years.
Correct.
And we want to just, I guess I'll just ask you right off the bat, Wayne, what has it been like hosting two students from the Middle East, and what got you interested in doing this?
First off, it was one of the greatest experiences of my life so far, hosting those two students. They've opened my eyes, broadened my horizons, and made me understand the Middle East a little bit better. What brought me to it is my friends Dave and Valerie Ringel hosted an exchange student first, and I met Omar, it was his name, and Yazan, who was also their exchange student, and I thought they were pretty cool kids. And then about halfway through Omar's year, he found that he needed a new home, and I opened my house to him, and he moved in with me and my little sister at that point. And since then, I can't imagine not having those kids in my life. They're like my sons now. The student I had this last year was Muhammad, and he was from Israel. Definitely opened my eyes about the Palestinian-Israel conflict that's going on here. When I first talked to Muhammad about it, he said that he was an Israeli. And I asked him, well, aren't you Palestinian also? And he said, no, I'm Israeli. But by the time he left, I understood that he was an Israeli-Palestinian. And I can understand the one-state principle here. I think that that's probably where this is all going to end up, is that it's going to be Israel-Palestine as one state. And I really hope that at some point in time that they work this out and that the two cultures can, you know, make it.
Now, of course, you had interactions with Aya, who was from Gaza this year. She was a close friend of Muhammad.
Correct.
And Nadine last year was from the West Bank, and they've obviously been affected by this conflict. You said you've learned more. How much did you start out, as Robert mentioned, a lot of Americans aren't aware of the facts on the ground in most of America's foreign policy, in particular in the Middle East and our involvement around the world. Where were you with these issues?
Well, I'll have to say that I was really blind. After 9/11, I was like, I don't like any of those people. They're all bad, and I don't want to have anything to do with them. Now that I've met these students, I understand that they're just like me. I mean, they're just like all of us. They're people, and it's our governments and stuff that are having conflicts, not necessarily the people on the ground. One of the exciting things for me this last year was that we had Hadi, who was from Lebanon, we had Aya from Gaza, and we had Muhammad from Israel. And they would party at my house all the time. There was no conflict between these kids. And that was like, well, that's what we want, you know, and they were wonderful students to hang around with.
Well, and of course, Muhammad may have been from Israel, but he was Muslim. All the kids are Muslim, and that's the first connection they make. I hosted a student last year from Turkey. I'll tell a little story about Bartram's experience. When she had come from the Kurdish section of Turkey, the Diyarbakir, and she was she told me she was just one of a few Kurds who came to the United States on any of these exchange programs. And she had a friend that she met through the program, first in Turkey, then in Washington, D.C., and then she went down and spent part of the Christmas holidays with a girl from Istanbul. And one of their days out together, her friend, and her name was Bazark or something, I don't remember, it was an unusual name, but anyways, her friend took her to a Turkish restaurant in Seattle. And they went inside, and Bartram immediately recognized the owner was Kurdish. And they had this conversation, and when they came out, Bartram's friend told her, she said, "I didn't know you were Kurdish, and I didn't know he was Kurdish, and I didn't know there were Kurdish could be good people." So a big part of what we all learn is that we are all people, and some of the prejudices that we have closest to home, sometimes you've got to go far away to dispel them.
Correct. Like I said, the kids were hanging out at my house this last school year, and, you know, Omar was from Egypt, we have Muhammad from Israel, Aya and Hadi, and, you know, I introduced Muhammad to Omar through Facebook and through Skyping, and they're really good friends now. I think it's sad that, Muhammad and Hadi have become really good friends, but they can't see each other crossing the border because the border is closed. They can go to Jordan, or they can go to some island in just off of the Israeli coast to see each other, but they can't enter each other's country. And for me, it is really sad that I can't go visit all of these students if I go and visit Israel. If I visit Israel, I'm not allowed into any of the other Palestinian or into like Lebanon, any of those countries, because I have that Israeli stamp in my book. And it's the same way if I have a Lebanese stamp in my book for my passport, I can't get into Israel. They won't let me in.
I wasn't aware of that. I thought you could travel to any country from here. I just thought that they were close to each other.
No, if you have an Israeli if you have your passport and there's an Israeli stamp in it, is my understanding that you cannot visit pretty much any other Muslim country.
Are you planning to go there and visit?
I am definitely planning to go and visit the kids. And the way that I found that I have to do the trip is that I have to go to Yazan's country, which is
Kuwait,
and then go to meet the kids like Aya and Omar and Hadi in Cairo in Egypt, and then I can enter into Israel and see Muhammad.
Now Gaza would be a tougher place to get into.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And the West Bank probably from Israel as well.
Correct.
So now you hosted 2 years in a row. Do you plan to do this again?
Yes, I do. I highly recommend it. If you want a wonderful person in your life, host an exchange student from the Middle East. They're awesome kids. They come from good backgrounds, and they're honest people. They're good, they're loving, and they're caring. You just have to learn how to work with their dietary needs, you know? It's a little bit different than ours. There's no pork in the household. No alcohol, but other than that, there's nothing that's different.
And how much work was it hosting? I mean, how much involvement did you have? I mean, they're high school students. How much independence did they have? How much did you give them relative to what you would expect from a typical American high school student?
I would say that they were just like our high school students. You set boundaries and rules and follow the guidelines, you know. It was really difficult to get Muhammad off the couch out of FIFA.
And what is FIFA?
FIFA is a soccer game, and he would sit there for hours and play FIFA. Go outside and play. Just go out. Do something. Go with your friends. And, you know, by the time the year ended, he was going out with his friends and doing stuff and having a great time in our community.
So it takes a little while for them to make friends here.
Correct.
Do they complain at all about kids they meet rejecting them in any way because of where they're from or because of their religion?
You know, I haven't heard any bad comments about the schools or anything for the two students that I've hosted or the two other students that I've met. It was just an awesome experience for them and an awesome experience for the schools. I know out at Thunder Mountain High School where Muhammad went, the kids were like, cool. We knew Omar last year. You've got to be just as cool as he was. And it turned out that, yep, he was.
So tell me about some of the things the kids did that got them integrated into the schools.
I know that Aya was into robotics, and she did really well in that and traveled with the robotics team at Thunder Mountain. Muhammad got into the boys' soccer team and did all their functions, and we did a lot with soccer. I'm not sure, you know, they hung out in the library. They did community service in the library and throughout the school.
What about Omar Yaz? Now, I recall Yaz broke his leg right after he got here. Shortly after he got here playing soccer. Were you there when that happened?
Yes. We were at the field house, and it was probably October, I want to say, when it happened. We were playing men's indoor league, and he broke his leg. It was an interesting conversation. I was at Bartlett Hospital with him, talking to his father on the phone, trying to understand Arabic and try to say he's okay. He'll wake up here in just a few minutes and you can talk to him, and calming his dad down, who was in Kuwait. And the time difference is really wild, because when we're up here, they're asleep there and vice versa. And so we had a recuperation process with Yaz, you know, took him around everywhere. He was just like a normal kid. You know, I broke my leg, but I'll go on. And he had a great attitude about it.
Now, I know he applied and was accepted to go to school at UAS. I doubt he'll actually come here again. But he was interested in it. Have you talked to him about that since?
I have. He was accepted to UAS here. He's actually going to Vancouver, British Columbia, to go to the university there. The two countries have an exchange program where he's allowed to come and go to school for the duration, and it's a lot less expensive for him to go to Canada as it is to the United States.
So you may go down and visit him down there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'll not have a problem doing that at all.
Now, and what was Omar? I know Omar played. Well, he was tall, and I think he was on the basketball team, if I recall.
Right. Omar played basketball. He was going to play baseball in the spring, but decided that he just didn't have the genes in his body to make baseball work, and so we had him play soccer. And he played the whole season of soccer and was a great player. Like I said, I can't imagine life without these two boys in my life, so...
So, and did you, while they were here, how much communication did they have with their families back home?
Quite a bit. Skyping is really, really big, where they would sit on their computer and face-to-face with their families. I was able to sit and have conversations with Muhammad's dad on the phone and with his mom and his grandma. And sometimes Muhammad would have to translate some of the words for me because I wouldn't quite understand what they were saying, and vice versa for them. But we're family now. I mean, his family wants me to come and hang out with them for, you know, a couple months. And I'm like, okay. So I plan on going and visiting Israel and seeing what the country's like. I want to say that Muhammad probably talked to his family every 2 days or so, sometimes more than that. But, you know, when things were blowing up over there, he was on the phone with them. And the same with Aya. I know that she was talking to her family quite a bit when things heated up in Gaza here last year.
Yeah, that's right. Israel had some military actions against Gaza in November, I believe, last year. And she was, she was in contact with her family every day is what I heard.
Correct.
I didn't talk to her specifically about it. But
for me, a scary experience was when in Egypt... When Omar was here, they had the overthrow of the government, basically, is what happened, and things were really heating up, and it was happening in Port Said, where his family lives, and, you know, we were there with him and supporting him and saying, you know, if we need to go, then we'll get you there or do whatever we can for you.
So going back to your gaining interest and knowledge of the issues in that part of the world, so would you have paid attention to the happenings in Egypt had Omar not been living here as though they were happening?
Probably not. No, it doesn't affect me. Why should I care?
So now you have this new problem or this new awareness of things, and obviously you're trying to do something positive in the sense of hosting the kids. You're getting a lot of family quality experiences out of it, but you're also getting very involved in elements of the world that you weren't aware of. I mean, and as you pick these things up, do they come more from the kids, just from being around the kids, from the communication with the parents? And how important is all that to you now, to understand, to gaining an understanding not just of their culture, but of the world and the conflicts in their world?
It's really important to me. At Christmas time, Khalid came and visited us, which was Muhammad's friend from Israel. Things that we didn't hear about here is that with the new settlements in the West Bank that they're talking about, that we just mentioned, that they were having riots in his village because of them. And we didn't hear about it here, but I heard about it from the kids online and from Muhammad, and pulled Khalid to go and stay with Muhammad until it was over with, and he and his family went and stayed with Muhammad. I wouldn't have really thought another thing about it before, and now I'm like, well, yeah, I can understand why you guys are upset. I can understand why, you know, the things that are happening, and you kids are staying out of it, but you're still upset about it.
Now, Khalid was from Israel, you said?
Khalid was from Israel.
And he was in the U.S. on the same program?
Correct.
And his family was, the demonstrations or riots or whatever you referred to them as a result of some settlements, that was occurring in Israel?
Correct, in Israel.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't have heard about that. In fact, I doubt you could find that anywhere in the mainstream news.
No, and it went on for 4 or 5 days. Just a couple of days ago, I still saw ambulances and the military and everybody else in his village, you know, pictures that he was posting online.
So do the kids feed you information continually then as you're in touch with them about things you're not aware of? And do you inquire more?
I definitely inquire more, and I get a lot more information. When things start heating up, like in Cairo, I call Omar to find out if he's okay or not. Things happen in Port Said, where his city is, and then I really get concerned, and, you know, I want to know why it's happening. What's going on? Why aren't my kids safe, you know?
Well, and you know, Bartram, again, she was in, she's from Diyarbakir, Kurdish side of the country. When Turkey went through their turmoil, began in Istanbul over the last green belt in the city, there were a lot of protests, and she got in touch with me, and she was asking me to post things on Facebook. She was out protesting for the first time in her life. She was attending demonstrations. It was sort of a proud moment for me to know she was doing that, to know she was getting engaged. I think she would have done it had she not come to the U.S. That was that's innate in her characters to stand up against injustice, as it seemed, to some degree. And having experienced a lot from being a minority group in her country. But she definitely, you know, taught me something. Because, I mean, I wasn't ready to do those things until I was 50.
Right.
You know, and kids coming from this part of the world, I think, have the ability to teach our young people not only what it means to be involved, but the imperative nature of being involved. They have to be. And yet they don't, I don't get the sense that they frown upon it. They feel privileged to be able to when they can.
Right, exactly.
So I think the program, we do have students coming this year. You're probably aware, I hope you are, that we've got a boy coming from Gaza who will be in Haines. We'll have one of our students in Haines this year. We've got a boy who arrived Friday last week from Bahrain.
From Bahrain, yeah.
And we've got a girl coming from Yemen. And I believe the two in June will be going to JDHS. And have you expressed any, talked to the parents, host parents, will you get involved with these kids in any way? Do you know if they're going to play soccer?
I don't know if they're going to play soccer. I know that the one boy that came in on Friday, and forgive me, I can't remember his first name, Abdullah?
Abdul.
I think is his first name, is getting involved with the cross-country track team here at Junior Douglas High School. Spent probably 10, 15 minutes talking to him at the airport and with his host family. And basically I'm one of their alternates where he'll come and stay with me when, you know, if they're traveling and he can't go with them and needs to stay here for school. I will definitely be involved with this program as long as I possibly can be. It's a wonderful program, and like I said, I encourage you to get involved and, you know, help the students. I'm excited about the two other students that are coming. And anybody who's available when they come in at the airport, come meet them. Welcome to Juneau. That it's important for them to know that this community reaches out to them.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me tonight, Wayne. I think I've been really appreciative of the work you've done. I think your interest, the story that you tell as coming from sort of in the shadows of the awareness of all of this and getting interest is an inspiration to, like I said, I didn't become aware of things till I was quite older, and it's nice to see other people making the same steps. I think the program obviously is a wonderful program, and I appreciate all you've done for it. Okay. So, thanks for joining us. I would like to add that we will probably the Juneau People for Peace and Justice has both the past 2 years hosted these students to present their community or their country viewpoints and interact with the community members about the program they're in. They have the students have a role as ambassadors of sorts. They are one of their goals is to come and build a relationship between the Muslim world and the West. And they take it seriously, and they're very, very bright kids. We had Hadi that you mentioned was from Lebanon. He was on Peace Talk once, either last April or May, I think. I wish I could tell you now. You could go in and dig that up out of the archives and listen to it. He was an incredibly, incredibly articulate young man, and I was really a privilege to know him. But with that, I think we're about winding down for the program tonight. Again, this is K2's Focus in Community and Peace Talk. Thank you for joining us. I want to thank John and Dolly Kremers for running the control board here, which I still haven't learned to do, and for getting in touch with Robert Jensen, who I would like to thank again for giving us his insights into the Middle East conflict. So, again, this is K2, and have a good night.
The end of war.